going to start part two of a three-part weekly series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. This is a theme that runs through much of what we talk about here on Issues, Etc. You may have noticed this from time to time, that there was a very famous media watcher, Marshall McLuhan, who's famous for many things indeed. He coined the phrase global village. He really has shaped much of the communications education of people in the United States and worldwide in the last three decades in a way that no one else has. Most famous quote, "The medium is the message." Now, why would that matter so much? Well, it matters an awful lot if you have a message, because then you should be concerned about the medium too. There are questions that swirl around this whole concern. Is technology neutral? When you watch the news at night, are you watching what's really happening? And I'm not talking about them trying to fool you. I'm talking about the constraints of the medium of television, that it has to have pictures and sound, that it needs to be explained, that pictures are naturally, especially when we're talking about video, pictures are naturally incomplete. We see a second or two. When was the last time you took out a stopwatch and timed how long the last video bite you saw on the news was? You might be surprised how very short it was indeed. Now, we all recognize that you can't learn as much from a soundbite as you can from watching, say, a whole speech. That you can't learn as much from watching the president walk across the lawn of the White House and jump into the helicopter as you can from, say, reading his policies. The medium of television is an image-based medium. It's an image-dependent medium. And how does it change the message? If politics were the only thing, that wouldn't be such a great concern. If it were only the news that is quickly morphing into entertainment, it would be a concern, but it wouldn't be an enduring concern. It'd be something that one could deal with. But when the message is more important, in particular the Christian message, can we say that the medium is neutral, that the technology is neutral? Or should we always have that concern about how the medium not only affects the message, shapes the message, but in the end becomes the message? Part two of a three-part weekly series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. Arthur Hunt will join us here in just a moment. He's author of the new book called The Vanishing Word. If you'd like to join us, our phone number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Here's the experience that I have had, and this is just by way of illustration. And perhaps I've said this before on the air. I don't remember. Whenever the president addresses the nation, I always try and listen. Part of me says it's my obligation as a citizen. Part of me, since I do a radio program, it's my obligation to listen, right? Sometimes I listen on the radio. I have other things to do. And so I put on the headphones or I'm driving in the car and I listen to the address of the president. And I try to evaluate very carefully what he's saying. There have been several occasions after having heard the president on the radio, this president in particular, but after having heard the president on the radio and absorbed the speech that way, just through my ears, when I have gone back and later seen the same speech delivered in front of a TV camera. There I am. Now I'm not just hearing it, I'm watching it. The same speech, the same occasion, with the addition of the visuals. I have been struck at how different the impression is of the same speech, the same words, the same ideas, with the visuals or without the visuals. With the image of the president standing there in the well of the House of Representatives and the entire Congress and Senate laid out before him, or without it. The last State of the Union address I heard the president deliver, I heard it over the radio. I thought, you know, it's not that strong. He's done better. And then I saw it on later that night on television. And it was like I was watching a different State of the Union address. I was amazed. He seemed resolute. His facial expression, his body language, just the setting itself, standing there in this historic setting among all the lawmakers that shape our lives. It was like watching a different speech because I saw something rather than just heard it. And I've had the opposite experience as well. Having seen it, thinking, boy, he was poorly lit. He looked worried. He looked like he was bound to the teleprompter. And then hearing it later, same speech, thinking, doesn't even sound like the same speech. Because the visual that had concerned me or distressed me or distracted me was gone. Have you had this experience? People have been talking a lot lately about the president landing in the jet on the deck of the Abraham Lincoln, USS Abraham Lincoln, out there in California. What a stunning visual. I didn't see it for about a day and a half. I heard people talking about it. I had my hopes so high about what this might be. And then suddenly, when I saw it, I thought, what was the big deal? Just looked like an ordinary guy getting out of a plane in a flight suit. And it happens to be the president. People are worried that aircraft carrier was situated for the president's subsequent speech to put the sun behind him, to put the open sea behind him. What do people understand about that? They understand that the visuals in our age are, if not as important, sometimes even more important than what the president had to say. That's just one example. If you'd like to join us in this part two of our three-part weekly series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture, feel free to join us. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Arthur Hunt will join us. He's author of the new book, The Vanishing Word. I've recommended a book on several occasions here, and it's one that forms, in a lot of ways, the subtext, the backbone of Hunt's work, but it's also a book that if you watch television even an hour a week, you must read. It's a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. He's been a guest here on Issues, etc. His thesis is that television is an entertainment medium. That's what it does best. And that's what it does even when it's doing other things. When it's giving you the news, it's entertaining you. When it's bringing you footage from around the world, be it the war in Iraq or a foreign summit of dignitaries, it's entertaining you. It must, above all things, entertain. Otherwise, what do? We stop looking at it. If it cannot grip our attention by in some way entertaining us, well, we never turn the thing off. We just walk away. Or, worse yet, we change the channel to something that does entertain us. The medium itself, he says, has a built-in mandate that shapes everything it carries, entertainment. Now, can we bring that technology or its kissing cousins, the giant jumbo screen, into the church without expecting the medium to shape the message if it must entertain? You see, the message that we have as a church is far more important than what the president said yesterday. Now, the president, he can mispronounce a word. He can get a dignitary's name wrong. People know what he means. He'll be corrected later. He has the luxury of going back later and saying, let me clarify my comments. But the Christian message, if not proclaimed rightly, can leave people in despair. The Word of God, if so shaped by its medium that it... where the message changes, can rather than leading people to eternal life, lead them to eternal death. This is a crucial question for the church. If it were only that, if it were only the culture, there wouldn't be that kind of concern. But there is, because we're talking about a message that means life or death. The phone number is 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Now, I read a lot. I read more than I used to. I thought I used to read a lot, but now I read a lot. I read books, I read newspaper articles, I read magazine articles. What I've noticed about this, and maybe you've noticed it as well, people are going back to reading a little bit because of the internet. The internet, by and large, is text. The big breakout of visuals in the internet are mostly just bells and whistles on the average website, right? When you look at a newspaper article or a headline, you can read it. You can go back and reread it. There's the quote in black and white. You can evaluate what is said. You are not subject to the reaction that you may have of how the guy looked or what his inflection was. You are simply evaluating the simple words that are there. There is something to reading that is altogether different from watching an image. Think about it this way. Have you ever turned down the sound on your television when you hit the mute button? What you get is the closed captioning. My television automatically gives me closed captioning every time I hit the mute. And I watch the television with the mute down a lot because I have kids. The sitcom isn't as funny when you gotta read it. It's the same words, but you can't hear the laugh track. The news seems a little less interesting when you have to read it rather than, and you can't compete. There you are reading, but you can't at the same time read and look at the visuals. We think we're getting more of the truth with the visuals. We think we are complementing the message when we add the visuals. Could it be that that medium, rather than opening up communication, restricts it? And now, I'm not arguing against visual communication. I think it's a great thing. But maybe it can only communicate one or two things, like entertainment. Those are some of the things we'll be talking about during this hour of Issues, Etc. Arthur Hunt is our guest. He's author of a new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. Arthur Hunt, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be back, Todd.
Arthur, last time we talked about the basic difference of medium, of technology. Let's review a bit, and then I want to talk about when did this change. Here's the question. Is technology, be it television, radio, anything that helps us or aids us in communicating, is it neutral?
Well, of course, in my book, The Vanishing Word, I have to first establish an idea that is somewhat foreign, I think, to most Americans, and that is technology is really not neutral, that it has both good and bad consequences. So many times we embrace any type of technological progress as good. We think of any type of technological progress as good. But I think that many people are beginning to realize that we can sometimes create a monster, not only in such areas as bioethics, but my concern is with electronic media and considering the ways in which our new media affect our culture, for good and ill. Of course, I think I focus more in the book on some of the ill effects of electronic media.
What are the characteristics of, you talk about a word-based or a word-dependent culture. What are the characteristics of that? Because it doesn't seem we live in that culture very much anymore.
Well, I'd like to use the a pretty well-known quote by Neil Postman, in which he describes what he calls the typographical mind. The typographical mind is a way in which we look at things, and I think it best can be summed up by thinking of the printing press and how it shaped the minds of those who use print primarily for their way of public discourse. I would say, as Postman has mentioned, that to a large degree, the printing press allowed individuals to have a high valuation of reason and order, a large capacity for sustained inquiry, detachment and objectivity, a tolerance for delayed response. And of course, my thinking is that if the printing press was capable of propelling Europe out of the Middle Ages and into a modern one, why should we think it strange that our new electronic media are not also capable of changing the information environment and our way of seeing the world? And I think it has.
Now someone's going to say, look, in fact, we talked about this last time, Arthur, the changes that was brought, that Gutenberg wrought in his invention have by and large been judged by history to be altogether positive. So here comes television, here comes the internet, the visually dependent medium, culture, mind. Why can't we expect even further progress, upward and onward?
Well, I believe we've left our modern age and we've entered into what many people call a postmodern age. And one of the tenets of my book is that postmodernism is, and this is how I define it, is characteristic of an embracing of spectacle and at the same time a turning away from rationality. And I think that electronic media has a lot to do with that. There are other factors, and I talk about some of those factors in the book. And so I'm not being a hard technological determinist, but I think that we cannot avoid thinking about some of the consequences on how electronic media shape our information environment for ill. In contrast to Postman's definition of the typographical mind, I would like to suggest that the postmodern mind rebels against reason. It has an abhorrence towards sustained inquiry. It has trouble distinguishing fact from fiction. And it has a remarkable ability to hold at the same time two ideas which logically contradict each other.
That's about as stark a contrast as one could paint.
It's a very stark contrast.
When did the change take place, Arthur? I mean, you can point to Gutenberg as really the instigator of so many things, like you mentioned the Reformation, you talk about the Puritans, you talk about all of the things that shaped Western civilization for the better. Where would you point to say, here begins the slide down the slope that is the stark contrast you just described in an image-dependent culture?
I don't think it happened overnight. Many people like to point to mid-20th century as the beginning of postmodernism. I don't think that we can draw a line in the sand and say that drastic changes started in 1950 or 1960. I think it's much more subtle than that. If we look at the Industrial Revolution and what it spawned, of course, we can credit the Industrial Revolution with a number of different things. When we think about the Industrial Revolution, we think about various inventions, everything from the sewing machine to the cotton gin, eventually the automobile. But I believe it all began really with the invention of the telegraph. You know, it was Samuel Morse who had the prophetic words in 1844 when he invented the telegraph and when it was first used, "What hath God wrought?" Of course, I think he meant it in a very positive way, but it amazes me that Samuel Morse would attribute the invention of the telegraph to God, and it gives us some indication as to where Americans traditionally have assigned technological progress. But the telegraph was dynamic in the sense that for the first time we were getting information about the world in other different places in a very rapid manner that we had never gotten before. I like the way Henry David Thoreau described it in his writings. He said, "We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing to communicate." So this was the very beginning. And as we progressed further, we had the invention the invention of the photograph, and then later that would be followed by radio, and then cinema, television, and now the internet. So it hasn't happened overnight. It happened slowly, and it happened with as one invention of the Industrial Revolution of electronic media built upon the other, because each invention was an add-on rather than being something totally distinct.
We are not only observers of our culture, of course, we are also the stuff of our culture. We're the fabric of the culture. In a lot of ways, it's a product of what we do and think and say. My daughter was marveling the other day when we were talking about the days before the automobile. I was trying to describe to her, of course, I don't remember them either, but I was trying to describe to her what travel must have been like. And one by one, I needed to remind her, and she's a bright little kid, but I needed to remind her there were no telephones. There was no electric light. There were no ways of communicating over long distances, period. You actually had to foot it over there wherever you were going to carry the information. And it was almost, it seemed almost impossible for her, or really for myself, to imagine a world before these simple things that we take for granted, like you said, beginning with the telegraph. Can we really get a clear picture of what the world must have been like when it was a truly word-based or word-dependent culture?
Boy, that's a good question. I think it's very hard for us to imagine what the world was like. And I'm not proposing that we necessarily go back to that world, because the world before the Industrial Revolution had other aspects that were not very pretty. For example, people did not live as long. You're very likely to die of some disease that you would catch at an early age. If you were an expectant mother, you could die in childbirth. So there are many things that modernism gave us, modernity gave us, that I'm very grateful for. Again, technological progress gives us many benefits, medical advancement being one of those. But at the same time, I think we close our eyes to some of the negative effects. People are basically the same, I think, in whatever age that they live in. We wrestle with the same types of problems. We're in God's image, and yet we are fallen.
We've got about 20 seconds here before our break.
Yeah, I just wanted to, as we go into the break, mentioned that our culture, though, is comprised of our values, our practices, and our artifacts. That is what we make, and sometimes these are very interrelated. For example, what we do is often predicated by what we believe, and what we make, which would be our technologies, can dramatically influence both our values and our practices.
Let's pick that up right after this. Arthur Hunt is our guest. He's author of the new book, The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. Stay with us.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence, because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
The next generation, too smart for creation?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution.
Well, Ken, why do so many people believe creation's unscientific and only for the uneducated?
Well, this attitude isn't so surprising. Everywhere we look, we're bombarded with evolutionary ideas. In movies, books, museums, classrooms, we're constantly told about things that supposedly took place millions or billions of years ago. And this is especially a problem in our education system. Students are told there's no God, that all life can be explained by random processes. And the higher you go in school, the worse it gets. So it's no wonder that statistically the most educated people have the highest percentage of belief in molecules to man evolution. I saw this just recently in an article about Australia. It said that traditional churches aren't satisfying a more educated and more questioning flock. The article continues, educated people are saying religion is finished, there's no God, they don't believe in miracles. But the article's very misleading. People aren't too smart to believe the God of the Bible. No, they've just accepted popular ideas about millions of years, which begin with the assumption that there's no God. Oh, how we need to get the information to these people and to the church to show them real science actually confirms the Bible's account of creation.
And real science actually shows that the scriptures are correct about a young age for the earth. Find out more on our website, answersradio.com.
Five 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. The weather for St. Louis. Overnight, clear skies, low of about 49. For Tuesday, partly cloudy and a high near 77. Currently partly cloudy and 70 in St. Louis. More about the image-based versus the word-based culture is next on Issues, Etc.
All right, Issues, Etc. junkies, here's something just for you. It's a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. We'll be there broadcasting live along with Issues, Etc. regular guests, Rolf Preuss, Angus Manoos, George Mather, and Craig Parton. Here are some of the topics that they'll be discussing at this seminar. Islam, Catholicism Today, Postmodernism and Hypersecularism, Theological Liberalism, Defending the Biblical Worldview, and more. Now, $229 covers the seminar, lodging, and meals for a week. Call the Schwann Center today at 1-800-577-4848 and ask for information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June 20th through the 27th in Trago, Wisconsin. 1-800-577-4848. Or find information at our website, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Arthur Hunt is our guest. We're talking about an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. We're right in the middle of something you mentioned before the break, having to do with our beliefs, our actions, and our artifacts, or the things that we make, our technology. Dr. Hunt holds a PhD in communications from the University of Southern Mississippi, and he is author of the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. You can purchase this book directly through our radio program. We'll send you the book for a contribution of $15 to Issues, Etc. Now, the price includes shipping and handling. Have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready. Call the Issues, Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. The book is called The Vanishing Word by Dr. Arthur Hunt. Or you can make a $15 check payable to Issues, Etc. and mail it to us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The phone number again, 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Hunt, before the break, you mentioned our culture being the product of our beliefs, our actions, and what you said, our artifacts, and you said it is, or I paraphrase you in saying, it is somewhat naive to believe that the three are not interrelated and dependent upon one another. Expand on that.
Right. I was defining just exactly what we mean by culture, and this definition is really from Quentin Schultz, who is a communication professor at Calvin, and he defines culture as three components. First, our values, that is what we believe, our practices, and that's what we do. And then also our artifacts. Those are the physical things that we make. And all three components of culture, values, practices, and artifacts, are remarkably interrelated. For example, what we do is often predicated by what we believe. I mean, that's a given. But I don't think we realize sometimes that what we make, that is our technologies, can dramatically influence both our values and our practices, whether it be the automobile, machines of war, or electronic media.
Let's see if we can give some concrete examples connecting with what we were talking about before the break. What were the immediate consequences of the invention of the telegraph, then subsequently things like radio, television, the automobile, all of these things, these artifacts that are shaped by and shape our beliefs and our actions?
Sure. Well, I think the telegraph allowed us to get information immediately from different parts of the world almost instantaneously. And that was a radical thing, because before this time, news could only travel at about the speed of a human being on a horse. So to be able to get information from London in just seconds was quite radical. Information, because of the telegraph, became somewhat of a commodity, and it was packaged for us, even though in a fragmented form and somewhat discontinuous. But it gave us information about far-off worlds, and we know that information today as the news, which many of us listen to every night on television. Along with that, about the same time, photography was being developed. And photography was also a different type of invention. There are several people who have made comments about the invention of the photograph. It was indeed a Victorian invention for the Victorian age, because it combined the Protestant concept of a divine hand of nature with the emerging miracles of modern science. Oliver Wendell Holmes, I think, had a remarkable take on photography. He wrote an article in the Atlantic Monthly back in 1859, and he said that the ability to separate form from the reality it came from marked the beginning of a new era where, quote, image would become more important than the object itself, and would in fact make the object disposable. And so you see this shift of the image of the object taking precedence over the object itself. So together with the telegraph and photography together, I believe they were just a dynamic duo taken together in the history of communication technology, and giving us really fragmented pictures of the world from faraway places, information that we really before these inventions either got over a long period of time, or really we didn't think that we really needed that information at all.
I want to talk about what you call the machines of show business, but first, you know, there's someone who's listening to us just getting off a hard day at work. They're looking forward to going home and turning on the television and soaking in some of the images, be it the news or entertainment, and they're thinking, what's the big deal here?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're so used to it. It's now a part of our lives. It is part of the culture. You posed a question a few moments ago about your daughter, and you were asking her questions concerning what was the world like before the invention of television or before the invention of the telegraph. I think we have a hard time imagining such a world where people actually, at the end of a day, did not sit down in front of a television set, but rather maybe sat by the fireplace and read a book or told a story or played the violin or visited another family down the road. We're so accustomed to going home after work and eating dinner and flopping down in the chair and turning on the television set. And many times that set will stay on 4 hours in the evening, and we think nothing of it. It is a part of our lives.
And why should that be a bad thing?
It isn't necessarily a bad thing to watch television. I don't make that an argument. In fact, I have a television set, and I watch it. However, I think sometimes we don't realize, going back to my definition of culture, how technologies affect the quality of our lives. I think our lives have changed over the last 100 years in a radically different way. Just as one example, our lives are filled with much more noise than they used to be. You know, there was a time in which silence was considered to be a virtue, or to have time alone. There are many benefits to silence. Silence is needed for meditation. We need silence in order to read a book. Whenever we write in silence. Whenever we reflect on something, whether it be the nature of God or about our actions, we need silence. We need silence to think, and yet we live in a very image-bombarded, noisy world. One of the consequences of that, one of the unintended consequences that we don't think about, is that silence has also vanished. It's evaporated.
Let's talk about the machines of show business, what we've already touched upon a little bit here with regard to television. This seems to be stage two of the revolution that began, as you mark it, perhaps with the telegraph. Tell us about it.
Well, after the telegraph and after the invention of photography came a series of other inventions that we're all very aware of. The next big invention would be that of the motion picture. Now, at first, motion pictures were just novelties. As early as the 1890s, somebody could just enter a phonograph parlor or a billiard room, and they could put a nickel into a machine, into a 4 foot high box, and watch through a peephole a variety of human activities, such as a man sneezing, or a husband stealing a kiss from his secretary, or a strong man flexing his muscles. But very soon, the movie industry became a little bit more sophisticated. By the turn of the century, in 1900, there were 600 Nickelodeons that could be found in New York City. But 7 years later, within just 7 years, the number of theaters grew from grew to 7 million, which is a remarkable increase. And we started attending the movies. Americans became movie goers. It was a very radical change in leisure behavior. In the city, we had more time to spend, and we saw this immigration from the rural side of America into cities with industrialization. With urbanization, we had more leisure time, and so we had more time to spend at the movie theater. It's very unusual that the Industrial Revolution had a number of consequences, not just these inventions that we've been talking about, but it also weakened the strong ties of community and family. So when America moved to the big city, We also left home. Sons and daughters of Little House on the Prairie moved away from their mother and father, and as a result, there was a loss of community hold and accountability. So here you have people in large cities with more leisure time, more things to do, less accountability. And so for entertainment and amusement, going to the movies became one of the favorite ways of killing time. The movies came at a very convenient time because of this disconnect. Disconnect between community and family. What you had in these cities were really soul-starved urbanites who needed role models. They no longer had mom and dad. They were cut off from their community. And so where else to find role models but on the big screen? And so now you have the sons and daughters on the Little House on the Prairie in the big city looking up on the big screen to find attractive role models, and they were there. They were paraded across the screen, and they were looked up to. We did not get our cues on how to behave from mom and dad anymore, but rather we got our cues on how to behave from these stars, everybody from Gary Cooper to Betty Davis to James Cagney to Spencer Tracy. They became our role models, and that's a significant shift.
Tell us about in that line the birth of the celebrity, mm-hmm. Someone who is simply famous.
Right. Of course, I'm not the only one who has talked about the cult of celebrity, but that is another consequence of a media-driven culture. I think perhaps one of the best writers of this topic is Daniel Borstein, who wrote a book called The Image back in the 1960s, in which he described this shift from the hero to the celebrity. Before electronic media, not only were parents and preachers respected role models, but heroes were. Heroes are historical figures. Heroes are people that we read about that do great things, great deeds, people of achievement. But with the birth of electronic media and visual media especially, the hero has faded off the scene and has been replaced with the celebrity. The celebrity is different from the hero. The celebrity is someone, and this is how Borstein defines a celebrity, is someone who is known for their well-knownness. By that he means that you don't have to necessarily do anything great to do a worthy deed, to have any type of historical significance, to be a celebrity. All you have to do is be able to wiggle yourself under the spotlight and attract attention. And so now the what I call the cult of celebrity is very prominent today, which is surrounds our image-based culture.
We're talking with Dr. Arthur Hunt about an image-based culture and where the change took place. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. You have a rather telling quote from Christopher Latch in a book called The Culture of Narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read in part, I'll read what you have to say by way of summary. Our membership in the cult of celebrity, which you just mentioned, made us look out and see the world as a mirror. Loneliness and anxiety were conquered by gazing upon the grandiose self as reflected in those who radiated celebrity, power, charisma. You mentioned the interconnectedness of our values, our actions, and our technology. Had the technology come full circle back to our a sense of self now?
Well, I think from a Judean Christian perspective, the self is not idolized. Now, in pagan cultures, the self is idolized. I mean, that's what idolatry is. Idolatry is nothing but the worshiping of self, magnified through myth and the gods. You know, when we think of the Greek and Roman gods of antiquity, we think of large human beings who were imperfect. They're nothing but extensions of the self. That's totally different from the Judean Christian perspective, which focuses on God and God alone. And the self, as I mentioned before, is in the image of God but fallen. We worship a transcendent God. That is the Christian heritage. Paganism, in contrast, worships the self through the creature. If we look at Romans chapter 1 and its definition of idolatry, we find that what man did was turn his attention from a holy God and focus on the creature, whether it be an animal or a tree, but in many cases, man himself. The Greek said that man was the measure of all things. One of primary thesis of my book is that with electronic media, we have really taken the self and we've amplified it through the cult of celebrity, and that is a type of idolatry.
So has the electronic media, in fact, then facilitated man's base inclination toward idolatry to a greater degree than ever before? I mean, the Greeks could craft statues and stelae of man-shaped gods on their temples, but now we have the power to broadcast it internationally with all of the wizardry of computer graphics and everything, and music and images at our fingertips.
Right. It's much more... it's easier now. And surprisingly, there are more images. Now, we like to think of ourselves as being, in our modern age, as being very sophisticated, and certainly not anything like the Greeks or the Romans. I mean, we think of them as pagans. They were pagans, after all. But not only did we have technological advances that came out of the Industrial Revolution, but at the same time, we had the blooming of new ideas. During the same time that this shift occurred, which posed a radical assault against Christianity during the Victorian era, Darwinism it was a primary one, which took away totally a radical idea of saying that man was a product of chance and was nothing but an animal. And Darwinism spawned many other isms. You know, when you think of Marx and Freud and Dewey, you know, their philosophies to a large extent was based upon the idea of this material naturalism. Those ideas were beginning to infiltrate the culture at the same time that the machines of modern show business were just getting off the ground. And it almost gave an excuse, a moral excuse, to abandon our Christian heritage. The machines of show business kind of attached itself to that. And as a result, what we saw, what we see even today, is our human, the rawness of our human underside, the sex and the violence, and the tenets of modernism allowed for the exposing of this raw undersideness.
We have only about a minute and a half before we need to wrap up our conversation, Dr. Hunt. We would be remiss if we didn't mention kind of the postmodern telegraph, that is, the computer, email, the internet. With a minute and a half, its effect on our values, our actions.
Yeah, the internet. Again, let me say there are benefits. I think there are benefits to the internet. I have a computer as well as a television, and I use the internet quite a bit too. But I think sometimes we don't realize that the internet is slowly becoming a machine of show business as well. You know, when we think about the radio, television, cinema, the internet, when these inventions were created, or when they were being introduced into the public domain, they were touted as being aids of democracy or aids of the industrial complex. But one by one, they all slowly fell into the hands of showmen, and the internet is another example of how a technology is becoming a medium of entertainment. Not only that, but I believe that eventually, that when the internet and television merge together down the road, as many people have predicted it would, it's going to carry with it the same values of Hollywood, an industry that for the last eight decades has set all of our standards for what we consider to be beautiful. And of course, there's the problem of internet porn as well.
Well, we'll talk some more about that when we come back, because the internet is definitely merging into not only a way of getting text, but also getting our images. When we again talk to Dr. Arthur Hunt, we'll be talking about the irrationality of spectacle. Dr. Arthur Hunt, thank you very much again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It was my pleasure.
Arthur Hunt is author of the new book called The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. He holds a PhD in communications from the University of Southern Mississippi. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, we have a new one coming out, or if you'd like to purchase Dr. Arthur Hunt's new book called The Vanishing Word for a total of $15, or if you'd like to make a donation to Issues Etc., call our resource line. It's 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. This is of crucial importance, folks, because the way we communicate our message is not neutral, and the way we receive our information is not neutral. No more neutral than the message or the information itself. The church has a message that cannot be tampered with, and we must guard, no matter what its medium, no matter the media that is used, against such tampering as well. We'll talk more about that next time with Dr. Arthur Hunt. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.